Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what insanely stupid, silly, and inane things we find to squabble over in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area to find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show. Just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. Now, my own blog is located at howtheneocons.stolefreedom.blogspot.com. And last week I had two new entries. The second Blackstone addendum provided advice. Many of you said you wanted on how to deal with what's coming this September through Christmas with the markets and, sadly, with your pensions and annuities. This week you'll be able to read about those ugly mortgage scams explaining what's really going on. If you answer your phone, you know how often you get these eager calls from everyone and their brother wanting to refinance your place. If you've wondered, you're absolutely right. Don't bite. And look for that article at the beginning of the week on my blog, at the Iconoclast and elsewhere. Now, as to what's been happening this week in presidential politics, the Ron Paul challenge from South Carolina resulted in over 1,000 people arriving to listen to Ron Paul talk about the issues that are troubling Americans today. The crowd was excited, they were enthusiastic, and much to the disappointment of some people, they looked completely normal. You'll remember that Spartanburg had told Ron Paul to stay out of their town through the local chairman of the GOP. Now activists are working on two straw polls coming up in South Carolina and Iowa. So stay tuned for more information coming up, and watch out for the fraud Thompson machine, which has lots of bucks from neocon coffers. And now our thought for the week ahead. The attempts to staple us to the grids continue. Listen to this bald attempt at coercion via Homeland Security. Also remember that this month the Bush issued a threat to grab the property of people who dare to protest the war in Iraq. Think about that for a minute. We all remember how we protested the war in Vietnam, at least those of us who were around then, and people have been protesting this war. Can you imagine telling people that they're going to lose all the property they own if they dare to protest? Where did the Bill of Rights go? All of this leads us only to one place, impeachment and taking back the reins of power as outlined in the Declaration of Independence. Now, this article appeared in Computer World on July 18th. Despite several state and federal efforts to force noncompliance with the new Federal Identification Law, or Real ID Act, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, has continued work on the law's guidelines that warn states that they face consequences for failing to comply. The Real ID Act, passed by Congress in 2005, mandates national standards for all state driver's license and other official documents. The DHS hasn't released a final version of the law, but the agency has said that it will require the documents to include a digital photograph and a barcode that can be scanned by electronic readers. The initial compliance deadline is next year, with full compliance required by 2013. The Real ID Act led to an outcry from privacy advocates and to the passage of laws in some states, including New Hampshire, that prohibit compliance with the law. Despite the criticism, the DHS continues to insist that the law be implemented on schedule. Quote, I think residents of states that chose not to comply are going to be displeased with their leadership's decision when we get closer to full implementation, unquote. A DHS spokesman said, quote, they'll no longer be able to do certain things that carriers of state-issued driver's licenses take for granted today, unquote. He noted that residents of states whose identification cards don't comply with the law will be prohibited from entry to airports and federal buildings. It could also block access to, quote, certain critical infrastructure sites such as power plants or dams, he said. Critics won a small victory against the law last month when Montana's two Democratic senators, Max Baucus and John Tester, successfully called on colleagues to cut language from a now-stalled immigration bill that would have required all employers to check the eligibility of any potential employee by using Real ID documents. My boss and Senator Tester don't support the Real ID program, as do a majority of Montana citizens, said a Baucus spokesman. It amounts to a national ID system, and there are privacy concerns. Tim Sperapini, legislative counsel at the Washington Office of the American Civil Liberties Union, said that the deleted language would have led to a massive expansion of the Real ID compliant documents. In effect, it would have made a driver's license an employment document, he said. Sperapini predicted the final regulations will come from DHS around Labor Day, and individual states not now opposing Real ID will have to decide if they want to reject it or implement it. The DHA spokesman declined to offer a specific date for when the final regulations would be issued. The grids that the neocons and their corporate employers are so eager to make sure we are stay stable to can be exited. There are many exits, and you're going to be hearing about those here. And it's important to remember as we talk about things that all of those grids are really about money. The solutions are all about us as individuals and the communities where we live. Today we're going to talk about another little weapon in their arsenal to staple us to their grid of greed. Getting off the grids begins with you and your community. Community is your relationships with those who live close to you. Those things we call neighbors are really, really wonderful things, and they're part of all of our extended security system. And the wonderful thing about getting back into community is that it is not rocket science. We can all do it. People all over the country are rediscovering the wonders of relationships, getting to know each other, becoming involved in their communities, providing more and better small local ways to establish the world as it was before the grids began to devour us. One of the people who's working on that, where it really counts in his own small community, is Arthur Ogawa. Arthur Ogawa is a resident of Three Rivers, California. With his family, he has lived there since 1993, immigrating from the San Francisco Bay Area. He was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and had a career as an experimental physicist at UC Berkeley, working at facilities such as the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, Fermi National Laboratory, Brookhaven National Laboratory, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. He turned to technical consulting in 1986 in order to work at home with his wife, Marianne Goldine. He has worked as an electronic publishing consultant for some 20 years, serving clients such as Apple, HP, NASA, and Boeing. Now Art keeps home fires burning while Marianne pursues a career as a computer programmer, and his daughter and son develop web comics, music, painting, as part of their continuing self-directed learning. Arthur has studied Oriental martial arts, healing arts, and herbal cooking for many years and currently teaches classes in Taiji Chuan. He enjoys riding his bicycles, both road and single track, and helping his neighbors with their computer problems. The Kauai Food Co-op of Three Rivers is a group of some 30 families who work cooperatively each month to provide high-quality, cost-efficient food for their families and the community. Meeting once every 4 weeks, the co-op distributes food obtained from local sources on a nonprofit basis. Members order their items. The order is consolidated and placed. and the case lots are repackaged for the members. The public is welcome at the food distribution night, where they may purchase goods from the co-op's inventory. The co-op dates back 25 years, and some of the founding members are active still today. Co-ops are one of the tools that we use to get off the grid and live healthier lives. And so we're very happy to have Dr. Arthur Ogawa with us today to talk about that. So please welcome Dr. Ogawa. Arthur, are you there?
I am. Thank you very much. It's great to be here and talking with you, Melinda.
Well, I'm so glad that you could be with us to talk about all of this. As I know, this community and taking us back to community is something you're very, very much committed to.
I am. We joined the co-op as soon as we moved to Three Rivers. We've been members for 14 years now.
That's a while.
Oh, and I wanted to mention the name of the co-op, Kuia Food Co-op. It's named after our local river here, the Kuia River.
Oh, that's nice. And that sounds like an Indian name.
It is. It's a Yokut's name. It means raven.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good thing, too. So how did you get started? Did you know about the co-op before you moved there?
We did not. But we learned about it shortly after we moved in. We were introduced to it by friends, and I had been longing to participate in a food co-op or food conspiracy, as it was known back in the 60s, for a long time. So we were pleased to be able to participate in this.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the co-ops that are still around sort of date from the 60s, when people were thinking about this same issue. They were thinking about local community. They were thinking about being proactive and being healthier and mm-hmm. cutting the costs.
Our co-op dates back 25 years. The first food co-op I ever heard about was in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, while I was attending the university there. That would have been in the mid-60s. It was delightful. I've encountered food co-ops in Berkeley, California. They're all over. In fact, I believe there are food co-ops currently operating all over California.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, California wouldn't be the only state involved.
No, I think that they actually are all over in places that it would surprise people where they are.
I don't think they talk to each other very much, though. Food co-ops, they create a community within their local area, but I've never heard of an organization that allows food co-ops to share information with each other. That would be beneficial. But in the meantime, every 4 weeks, we order something like perhaps 30% of the food that, by dollar value, that we will use in any month through the food co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to clarify that the food co-op got started as a vehicle for ordering food through the Mountain People's Warehouse, which was a food distributor that specialized in distributing to health food stores. It was necessary to meet a minimum order. It was necessary to order case lots. And so it required people to work together to put together orders for food that they could share out and which would, in essence, economically justify the MPW to send the truck up to Three Rivers.
Right.
Now, we have branched out through the efforts of our members here to purchase as much as possible through local sources. I say as much as possible. It's an evolving thing. Tulare County, where we are, is the largest agricultural county in California. I only say that as a chauvinistic thing. Actually, Fresno County is a very large agricultural county as well. But Fresno County, Tulare County is a very large agricultural county, very large in dairy, very large in stone fruit, and in many other things as well. So for the food co-op to buy from local sources in this predominantly agricultural county really makes sense. And
mm-hmm.
they're finding that there are plenty of sources of local food. There are a lot of very small-scale operations here in Tulare County that we can buy food from. And that pleases me. Mountain People's Warehouse, since the beginning, has now morphed into United Natural Foods Incorporated. It's a nationwide concern. And it's still a very strong resource for us, but we feel that local production of food is such an important issue, we make an extra effort to find local sources.
Mm-hmm. And that effort has actually involved you in taking a look at what happens to small family-run farms.
It has. It has. We're extremely pleased to be working with a farming operation that involves three generations of the same family in their work. That's where we get our eggs. It's Yoco Valley Ranch. Interested listeners can simply Google that, and they will find Y-O-K-O-H-L, Yoco Valley Ranch, by Googling it.
Mm-hmm.
We've also worked with a family farm of several generations standing in the Woodlake area, which is not very far from here.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Fresno area, Marion Farms, a biodynamic farm, which is also a second generation, or perhaps third generation, farming family in that area. That's
mm-hmm.
where we get our raisins.
Well, that must be very satisfying for people to know that not only are they buying food that was grown locally, so they know all of the things that food has been subjected to and how it was raised, but to know that the people that are producing the food are people that they probably know one way or another.
Those two factors are really important, very satisfying to us as consumers. And there's more to the picture. First of all, when you buy from a local source, you don't have to worry about designations like free range, organic, certified organic, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the farm is there to be inspected with your own eyes.
Right.
That's so important.
The most important kind of local inspection is the one you do yourself.
I completely agree with you. And direct contact with the grower means that we don't have to worry about things like designations like organic and so on. That's one. It means that our own judgment as consumers is empowered. We don't have to hand that off to the USDA or some other accreditation agency.
So what you're saying is that also takes back the power to the individual to make that choice instead of investing it at a federal level.
Absolutely right. Or even a state level. The responsibility for what you eat, it's your own. And you exercise that whether you like it or not, whenever you buy food or even whenever you eat food. Let's return to that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Make it a conscious one. There's another factor as well. Family farms, we all know that small-scale farmers are in danger, that hundreds of farms close every week in the United States. forced out of business by the grow or die, get big or die factor in the market today.
Yeah, I always think of it as the Walmart factor.
Perhaps so. Although there are plenty of low-income people who are grateful that Walmart exists. On the other hand, people at any level of income need to understand what they're doing when they pay, say, a dollar for a dozen eggs. You can go to Trader Joe's in Fresno or your local area and see six different price levels of eggs displayed. Some of them say free range, some of them say organic.
Let's get into that issue right now, because you've used the word organic before, and of course what's happened with that word is it's been corporatized.
It's been co-opted by the USDA. If you read the book Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, journalism professor at UC Berkeley, came out last year, he describes how the organic food movement that we all welcomed in, you know, in the 60s, in the ensuing 40 years, it has changed. It has suffered intensification, and the crowning blow came when the federal government demanded that they be the only ones entitled to say what is organic and what is not. That means California can't set its own standards for what we want to designate as organic. So I consider organic a tainted term. If I want to know about the food I'm eating, I no longer trust the organic designation. I don't treat it as a feel-good label on the package
anymore. So it's a brand that you can't trust anymore because they've been fiddling with it. And the reason they've been fiddling with it is because people want organic food, and they want to be able to put the word organic on things that really aren't organic.
Well, they may not be organic, but the most important thing is that they've essentially declared a monopoly on labeling. There should be no monopoly on labeling. One of the most important designations that I've ever seen on a package was CCOF, which stands for California something Organic Farmers. It was an association of self-certifying organic farmers. I know lots of CCOF farmers in California and have been enjoying their output for years and years. But designations like that have been co-opted by USDA Organic. There's even legislation in place now from the federal government that says that all of these sorts of standards will be set by the federal government so that no individual state will be able to set alternative standards. And the thrust there has been to industrialize organic, Michael Pollan.
And what this actually goes to is a tendency on the part of government to grab power.
Indeed.
And tell individuals and, you know, however they choose to organize themselves locally and at other levels, that they're not competent to handle that. And that sends several different simultaneous messages, which are all bad.
Yeah, so the fact that I can tell my members, you know, here's the address of where this produce came from, here's the address of where these eggs came from. When I get the eggs for you, I'm shaking hands with the person who you know, gathered them up. I can tell you when they were packaged. I can tell you how they were packaged. And you can go there and inspect them if you want. It's all within an hour's drive of here. So that's empowering. That's very important. It's political, but when I want to keep the focus on food and how you spend your money on your food and how you select your food. So instead of looking at the negative of these designations, I want to look at the positive of being able to deal with someone, you know, shaking the hand of the person who gathered your eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to actually visit the farm where your raisins were raised and where they were dried and processed.
So you could, in effect, actually be examining your raisins, the ones that you purchased that you're going to be using in, like, your mince pie.
Yeah, absolutely true. And, you know, you can see the trees that your oranges came from. You can see the farmer in his practice. You know, what does he do? You can say to the fellow who makes your strawberries, so what are you going to do now that you can't use methyl bromide anymore? You know, how will you proceed? And
mm-hmm.
so all of these things are important.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot, of course, people are becoming much more conscious all the time that their food is indeed a grid point.
Your food can be a grid point, or you can step off the grid. Will you grant me that?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I feel quite proud that, you know, what I'm doing when I go to a local grower is that different. It amounts to realizing the promise of, you know, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you've been, of course, involved, you said, for 14 years in the Kaweah Co-op. Tell us how that started and about the people who started it and, you know, something about its history, because I think that's really exciting.
Well, about a half a dozen people, I would say 100% of them women, gathered together in one of their houses and figured out how to put together a food order of sufficient size to have the MPW truck come to Three Rivers. And they kept it up month after month. They were all people with families. So we have kids who've grown up eating that food, who are now young adults.
Mm-hmm.
All the work was done by hand. All the paperwork was done in a ledger. It wasn't easy keeping track of all these different things by hand like that. But they did it, and each individual person in the co-op would contribute labor of some sort. They figured out how to divide up their jobs. The food co-op is an example of what happens when you have an anarchy. You know, the food co-op doesn't have a top-down organization. It has a steering committee, but the steering committee almost never meets.
And you just use the A word, of course, which everybody in, you know, who's familiar with the dialogue on that kind of organization, you know, always refers to the word anarchy as the A word.
Oh, really?
Because most people are scared of the word.
Oh, okay.
Because
well,
what they think of when they say anarchy is no order instead of spontaneous order.
Anarchy means no rule.
Right.
It means no bosses. And the food co-op, we were participating in quite some time before I realized, hey, there's no manager here. I realized that. People would come to me and say, Art, there's something wrong. You know, I see this as a problem in the food co-op. And I'd say, well, I believe the person you should be talking to is so-and-so in the food co-op. Why don't you talk to them about this? And then they would work it out between themselves, and somebody's job would get tuned up a little bit and work better. Who is the boss here? Is there a boss in this picture? No. So because there was no boss, I decided, oh, this looks like anarchy in action.
Mm-hmm. But I think people don't understand the difference between anarchy and, which, as you said, is, you know, the lack of, it's what you'd think of as a network of, not leaders, but people who are working toward a similar, toward the same goal that they've agreed on previously.
Yeah. I'd be happy to select a more comfortable term.
Oh, I don't care. I think it's a fine term because I think it invites a discussion of an important issue, you know, which is the assumption that to make things work, you have to have somebody telling other people what to do.
Yeah, that's certainly not the case in the food co-op. People essentially see a job that needs further attention, and they go out and do it. People see something's wrong, somebody maybe fell down on their job, ultimately figure out who it is they need to talk to, and they have that conversation.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the matter is mended in one way or another.
Yeah, it's all done in a network way. So maybe there's a name involving the word network to describe it that would allow us to step away from the A word.
Well, that would be fine, too. It's also obviously very consensual and cooperative.
Absolutely. And there's a high level of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And respect for each other.
True.
And those are all qualities that working well in a community sort of create a platform for other things to happen.
And they do. It's interesting that from our membership in the food co-op, we have made further friendships and developed relationships with people in the community to go beyond what the food co-op does, particularly in regards to food. For instance, my kids today are eating a roast beef sandwich. It's made with Three Rivers beef. This is an animal that has never seen a feedlot. It's been on grass its whole life. Grass, maybe with some alfalfa thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
These are cows that could have gone to a feedlot, but before that, they were slaughtered at a local slaughterhouse and butchered up, kept in a freezer until we're ready to use them. And so this means that people who, for instance, really don't want to have feedlot beef, don't want to have beef that was fed on grains, have an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people in Three Rivers who availed themselves of this sort of opportunity. It means that you buy an entire side of beef at a time, which means a big investment, but you're going to spend that money anyway.
And I think it actually makes it less expensive.
Well, that could be, but we don't count the cost. I feel that we don't have to ask people, our suppliers, to give us a good price. My policy, if I'm negotiating with a producer, a farmer, or whatever, a rancher, I ask him to name a price that he thinks is fair. If I can find a better price elsewhere or something like that, maybe the opportunity will arise. But the last thing I'm going to do is to say, can't you do, give me a better price? It's just my way of negotiating.
Mm-hmm. Well, people generally will give you the best price they can when you're honest and open about it.
Yeah.
It just creates a different formulation for the process.
Mm-hmm. I trust them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm already extending a great deal of trust by saying, I'll buy this cow, and or I'll keep on buying these eggs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course they want to honor the relationship because they know they're going to be dealing with you this month, next year, 10 years from now.
And it's not an anonymous relationship. If I buy Harris Ranch beef, for instance, I don't know Mr. Harris. The only thing I know about Harris Ranch beef is I can see their feedlot if I want to.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, avoiding the feedlot is one of the issues.
It is. And being face-to-face with the owner of the cow is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a lack of anonymity that works very favorably for both of us.
Because I assume what it produces then is a better outcome so that there's more of a sense of connection and there's more trust and it extends your community.
I love that. The outcome is community. I mean, we're talking about buying a cow, but the outcome is community.
Right.
That's so good. So that's another, you know, aspect of the food co-op. It's kind of like a spin-off. Another activity that I've found is just gathering food. It turns out that there's a lot of opportunities to harvest from a tree in somebody's orchard, a tree that, you know, oh, I don't know what to do with these pomegranates. I don't know what to do with these persimmons, these quinces. So there's a group of us who search out people who want to let us harvest from their trees. And in Three Rivers, there are a lot of very old orchards. These trees are, you know, 50 years old, 80 years old, and they're still producing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do a trade. We say, well, we will harvest and we will give you a box of the best of the persimmons that we harvest. Or we'll give you persimmon cookies or whatever. So those kinds of activities, I think they're called gleaning.
Yes, that is. That's a gleaning.
Although these trees would not be harvested at all if we did not harvest them.
So what you're doing is preventing the fruit from going to waste.
True.
Which is another very, very good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that also gives you more, you know, more supplies that you could make available to people who perhaps couldn't even afford to buy them. That could happen.
Well, that's true, and we're encouraging people to look on their trees as something more than just a useless occupier of space in their yard. So, for instance, there's a fellow who began watering his tree and mulching it because he knew we were going to harvest from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's beneficial to the tree, too.
So you're building out a community that also includes the trees.
Indeed it does. And people who wouldn't relate to them otherwise.
So you're making the tree a more valuable thing in the eyes of somebody who might have bought the property without thinking about the fact that there was this producing tree on it, which changes their consciousness about their own yard.
Yeah, indeed it does. It makes me happy. It makes me happy to think that there's a tree that whose fruit is not simply falling on the ground and composting there.
That's a really sad thought when that happens, when you see a tree and it's producing this fruit and it's just laying there.
Particularly when you consider how some people would really want access to that.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. So it honors the tree. The food co-op has enabled us to branch out and do more with our neighbors in the community. It's allowed me to meet people I would not otherwise have met.
And that's very exciting, too, I imagine.
It is.
So that, you know, you've reached out and you have a relationship with people in the community who that's the way you've really made contact with them. And there must be intergenerational aspects of that. So you're getting to know people who are, they're older. Maybe you would have never had a reason to ever talk to them.
Well, that's so true and very insightful of you to you know, realize that, to point that out. I'm meeting people who are, you know, in the next generation from me. And I feel like, in a sense, it's allowing them to, you know, connect with younger people. It's an excellent thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can't just go to someone's house and pick fruit. You have to have a conversation. So I learn a lot about the community from these people.
Mm-hmm.
They've been here a long time. They can tell me lots.
Well, that must be exciting, too, because you're getting insights into the community that probably many younger people who've lived here all their lives don't have.
Or I wouldn't have if I just, you know, kept to my own business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's changed my vision of where I live. Three Rivers to me is a collection of gems. You know, each person here has something special.
Oh, that must be very, very enriching, and you can see how that could extend out. I mean, if you wrote down the stories, you could have a history of Three Rivers through just the stories that have come out that way that would give people, I think, probably amazing insights into their own community.
Yeah.
And cause them to value it again in a different way.
Perhaps so. And it occurs to me that, you know, Three Rivers is not unique. In every single community, in every single local area, there are lots of people, stories, resources, wisdom. You know, I'm coming in contact with these many beneficial aspects because I'm after the fruit. But that's like, it's attracting me, but then there's a much greater reward.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can find this.
Well, and that's exciting. And when you think about the fact that all of these things are unique and all of these communities have these aspects, it makes you sad to think about how many communities are losing them as they don't do what you're doing.
Or perhaps we can turn that around and say it's very marvelous to think how, you know, as we begin to do that, we can create that,
mm-hmm.
that contact, that community, that connection, and to...
and maybe find more ways for people to find out about it.
Perhaps so.
That could be very interesting.
Seeing people connect is very good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I don't have to be the only one doing this.
Well, no, and you're not. As you said, there are a lot of people involved with the co-op and
mm-hmm.
have been over its history
mm-hmm.
that I'm sure brought other kinds of richness to the whole.
It certainly has been the case, yes. Yeah.
And the person who actually started it was a woman, wasn't it?
Everybody I know, everyone in that group was a woman. They were mothers. They were mothers of young children. I said when you contacted me, I wish that, you know, you were talking to one of our women members, because the food co-op is really an organization. Most of the labor is being contributed by women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Because it's normally women that do the cooking, so it's women who are generally responsible for that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that every one of those women has a very interesting story about why she became involved and what she learned and what she did. And that, again, is fascinating stories that gives you depth into the whole process.
Mm-hmm. It does.
And you've been doing this for quite a while now, 14 years, and your kids they didn't completely start on food from the co-op, but how old are your children? One of them is 20.
19, she reminded me today, and the other is 17.
Ah, so for most of their lives, they've been having the food from the co-op.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And they've been having another very much off-grid experience because they have been, instead of going to a regular school, they've been studying at home.
Yes, indeed. I'm not sure that's on topic, but it's true.
Oh, but we can do whatever we want to do.
Okay. There are a lot of homeschooled kids here in Three Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been very happy that there have been so many because we don't have to feel like, you know, lone wolves in that way.
Mm-hmm. And they do actually self-directed learning, right?
Yeah. We call it unschooling. Among homeschoolers, unschooling is a term that people know. Unschooling means that you design your own learning program. I think John Holt would be the most well-known advocate of unschooling.
Mm-hmm. And has the co-op been part of their unschooling experience?
Somewhat. When my back is hurting, I ask my son to come and help me, and so he gets to see the scene there where the where all the food is being repackaged and hauled out to people's cars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fun. At the particular occasion, it's in what we call our pickup night. People are coming in picking up what they've ordered.
Tell us more about that. Where does that take place?
It takes place in the basement of a church. This room is used as a preschool and vacation Bible school and so on. It's their community room. We rent it at essentially one night every 4 weeks. People come. A lot of times they're bringing their kids. And so the kids play with the preschool's equipment while we're doing this activity. In a food co-op, you don't have to order an entire case lot. You can share it with other people, and so that's one of the real advantages in being a member of the food co-op. There are good things out there. You don't have to buy an entire case. So it means that there's a crew of people whose job is to repackage it. It's our packaging crew. Maybe a 25-pound sack of rice is divided between five different families, things
mm-hmm.
like that. So that's one of the activities that's going on. And besides that, people are conversing. People are connecting up. People are having intense conversations. It's a place to connect up with your fellow members of the food co-op and, cook up schemes to get together outside of the food co-op and do something. These are people that might know each other, might see each other week in and week out, or not. And they only happen to see each other at food co-op, but they converse and form community.
So that gives a different aspect of the whole process then. They get to know each other in a different way. They see each other at the food co-op.
Mm-hmm. Indeed it does.
And, of course, these families have grown up over the 25 years. Are there any families that are actually, now they were raised on the co-op food and now they're raising their own kids that way?
That would be a second-generation member. I don't believe we have any of those yet. That would be interesting.
That would be interesting. Because it's obviously a very central part of the lives of the people, of your members.
Yeah. Well, certainly consistent. We have some people who were founding members and are still in there, or who left for a while and have now come back. We have people who've been at it for, 10 years or longer.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people who are just now coming in. We have people who drive, say, 20 miles to come here for the food co-op because this is the closest one. We have people who were food co-op members but found a way to establish food co-ops in their area. And so we don't see them on this night, but we're still in contact.
Mm-hmm. So, this is sort of growing out with other people learning the way that you do it and then going and doing the same thing someplace else.
Indeed.
And one of the other things we talked about are other things that you would like to bring into the whole process, like other ways for people to exchange value, a barter system, a system where they can exchange services.
Some of the members have been talking about alternative money.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, exchanging goods and services in a way that does not involve using our legal tender but some
or our illegal tender, however you feel about it.
Our fiat money. And we, in our family, have been working with another family here in Three Rivers for many years in a very simple barter where we trade our homemade bread for their goat milk.
Oh. That sounds delicious.
You haven't tasted real goat milk until you've tasted it fresh.
I believe that. And I've never had fresh goat milk. But I used to buy goat milk way back when. I didn't live in a place where I could keep my own goat.
Mm-hmm. It's been marvelous, and you know we're friends now, so you know it's not just about the milk and bread, but you know we keep it up.
Well, that must be wonderful too.
Oh, absolutely.
And that must build out those wonderful things called relationships.
Indeed, indeed. So with these particular folks, we do a lot of exchanges. We're also involved in this. In this gleaning thing. In fact, my friend who's in her 70s is the one who knows where all the persimmon trees are. And I don't know if you can appreciate this, but persimmons are an underrated fruit. It's really great to pick and preserve persimmons. And she was the one who knew all of the people in town who had the persimmon trees.
Mm-hmm.
She was the one who said, well, you can talk to Eleanor there. You can phone her up and say, hey, can we pick your tree? So.
Well, that must be a very interesting aspect of the process now, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have this relationship with the people that you're picking their fruit.
Yeah.
It almost make it like a little moving party.
It is. We're ranging around town with our picking sticks and our ladders.
What fun.
Indeed, it's lots of fun.
And this is such a change from what you were doing for a living, because here you were working as a physicist.
Yeah. This is heavenly. The ability to, you know, to have that freedom in my life right now. So I'm happy about it, very happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it gave you insights and ways of understanding the world from a different perspective, but equally valid perspective. Not the sort of thing most physicists ever get, though.
I see it as creating something. In my professional life as a physicist, I could create machines. I could unearth knowledge. In this work, in this activity, I'm creating bonds with other people. I'm creating community.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, becomes a baseline for many, many good things that could and should happen in our world.
It's a great way of being. One of the things about Three Rivers, a lot of people came up here to retire, and they were content to, you know, live a quiet life. And so in Three Rivers, because we're off in a corner, as it were, because we're out in the sticks, it allows people to take the attitude of, just leave me alone.
Well, that's a really wonderful attitude, and a lot of people want exactly that today.
I think that, you know, being able to live your life and to be left alone, is to have that opportunity is great.
Amen.
But at the same time, one need not live a lonely life.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Three Rivers, I'm finding that making connections, that's really nice.
That's That is. That sounds wonderful. Well, I'm so glad you could be here today to share this with us. And I'm hoping you're going to be able to come back again soon and that you're going to be able to keep giving us more information about what's happening, because I know you have other plans for changes and deepening and broadening your community.
Indeed, and I appreciate your invitation. It would be my delight. People who want to look further into the Kuia Food Co-op or contact me, we do have a website, kuiafoodcoop.org. That's K-A-W-E-A-H, Food Co-op, all one word, .org is our website.
That's fantastic, and I hope people check it out and get in touch with you about starting their own.
We would like to encourage that. If I may say, on our website, we're using software that we developed ourselves, and we would be pleased and happy to give that software to anyone who wants to use it. My wife and I developed it, and we consider it open source software. Right now, we are simply agreeable to providing it to anyone.
Oh, that's wonderful.
If they ask.
What a beautiful offer. Thank you. And thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
And we'll be talking to you soon. Take care. Thanks.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today, Friday, July 27th, 2007. At The Spiritual Politician, we tell you about ways you can connect to others to solve problems and make life better for all of us. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to pursue these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.